This evening, I want to talk about dealing with the most difficult person in your life. You have a lot of different people in your life. Some of them are rather pleasant. Some of them are not difficult at all. They're easy people to deal with. And then there are others who are a little less lovely. And then in everyone's life, there is a person who is very difficult. That person is yourself. Self is the most difficult individual with whom you will deal in your lifetime. To look at self tonight, I want to talk about two individuals, tell their stories to the extent their stories are known. These are real people. They lived, made choices, and died. Late in 1944, World War II was beginning to draw to a close in Germany. As the winter pulled on, you would say a cloud of defeat was hanging over Germany. The Allied nations, the Americans and the British primarily, had landed in Normandy in France and were driving eastward into Germany. To the west, it was only worse. The Russians were pushing eastward, and it's like Germany was caught in a vice. The Americans and the British coming from one direction, the Russians from the other. And under that pressure and that strain, the German armies desperately tried to defend Germany. Not all Germans were Nazis, not by any means, but they were in dire straits. The war had been going on for 5 years at this point, and Germany was exhausted. Yet in that exhaustion, Adolf Hitler, the dictator who ruled over Germany, and those who supported him, they had an aim in mind which they were not willing to compromise. Although they were very hard-pressed for manpower and material just to defend the territory they held, they pressed ahead with an entirely different war against the Jewish people, attempting to capture and then destroy all Jewish people residing within their borders. It was on an unmarked day in that winter, not certain if it was in late 1944 or early 1945, but on a winter day, a train slowed down as it approached a village in rural southern Germany. Trains can't go barreling through villages. They do have to slow down in case there's someone on the tracks, and that's what happened this day. The train came through the village every day. On this particular day, as the train slowed down, those who were out and about observed the train was pulling a long line of cattle cars. These cattle cars, everyone had an idea what was inside. It was not cattle. Those cars came through, that particular train came through somewhat regularly, and they always went to the same place. It unloaded people, Jews, at a concentration camp that was nearby, and many thousands went in, and nobody ever came out. And all day long, a thick black smoke rose over the camp from a large crematory where they burned bodies. That day in that winter of 1944-1945, as the train slowed coming through the village, those who were out and about noticed something. They noticed high up on the side of one of the cattle cars, they noticed a pair of hands appear. Around the top of the cattle cars, there was kind of like a slatted opening for ventilation, and those openings had been covered very thickly with barbed wire to prevent whatever was inside the cattle cars from getting out. But a set of hands appeared at the top of a cattle car and pushed wire aside, pushed strand up and pushed strands of wire down. The hands then disappeared briefly and lifted a small bundle wrapped up in cloth to the opening that was created, those hands hesitated for a moment, holding that bundle, and then threw the bundle from the train. A man who was walking nearby saw it happen, and after the train passed, he went to see what was in the bundle. As he opened it, he found a baby girl, an infant. No record of how old he thought the child was, but it was an infant. It was a baby. It was a girl. He knew full well what it really was. It was a Jewish child. It was a Jewish baby. A Jewish mother had understood what was going to happen to her. She understood that many people went into these camps, thousands, and none ever came out. That her life was short. She had already lost probably most of what she possessed in life. Most of her family by late 1944 would have been gone. Most of the Jews were gone. They were rounding up the remnants, the scraps of Jews that were left. So she probably had seen many family members and friends disappear already onto those trains, and no one ever came back. She probably knew that the destination wasn't far away. And if she was going to do something to save her baby, she needed to take desperate measures. And if you consider it, it was desperate measures indeed. She took great risk in throwing that baby from the train. It was a moving train. She could not see what was outside. She probably had an idea that the train had slowed down because it was coming into a populated area. And she threw the baby. When you throw the baby from a train, the train's moving, and the baby's going to fall. Where is the baby going to land? Is the baby going to land on concrete? On rocks? On the ground? In a ditch filled with water and then drowned? She wouldn't have known. But she knew in her mind, in her heart, what would happen to the baby if she kept the baby. So she decided to throw it. The man who found the baby was too scared to keep it. Would be a high price to pay for saving a Jewish baby. But he knew a lady that he thought might take the risk. So he went to his lady friend and he asked her, "Would you take this baby?" She was willing to take the baby, and she kept it and hid it. She raised it as her own, naming the baby Erica. Erica never knew her real name. Her name wasn't Erica. That's what the German lady called her. She didn't know her name. She didn't know who her parents were. She didn't know where she was from. She didn't know when she was born. So imagine going through life and never knowing when your birthday was or exactly how old you were. She didn't know if she was maybe the first child of a young mother, or if she was down near the bottom of a long line of siblings. She just didn't know anything. The only thing she knew was that whoever her real mother was, she said, "My mother must have loved me very much." Because there she was in a very vulnerable situation at the end of her life. Everything else had been taken away from her. And she understood full well that her own life was going to be taken very shortly. She had one thing left. She had her baby. And she was willing to throw the baby away in an attempt to save the baby. As Erica said later, "On her way to death, my mother threw me to life." That's the story of Erica and her mother. This lady's life was quite different. Her name is Stella. Stella Goldslag. Stella knew all about her life. Stella was born on July 10th, 1922. She was the only child in a fairly well-to-do, middle-class family. She grew up in a suburb outside Berlin, Germany. She didn't have a deprived existence. She was somewhat spoiled as a child, as only children sometimes are. She had a very comfortable life. She attended good schools. She was even going to secondary school, or we would say like junior college, to be a fashion designer. She had a future out ahead of her. She had an advantage, you might say, in a worldly sense, that in her day she was considered beautiful. Standards of beauty may change over time. You may look at Stella and you may or may not think she was beautiful. But in her day, she was considered beautiful. Those who knew her as a child recall that she was the prettiest girl in school. She was Jewish. Her family was not very observant, but when they did go to synagogue, that Stella Goldslag was the best-looking girl in the synagogue. She grew up knowing that she was good-looking and believing that she was good-looking. She had a problem, though. Stella's problem was that she was Jewish. She was a Goldslag. That's a Jewish name. She lived in Germany under the Nazis in World War II. One of the graces that saved Stella for a long time is that she didn't look Jewish. She was 100% Jewish on her parents' side, mother and father's side, but Stella had blonde hair and blue eyes. She looked like a German fashion model. She didn't look like a Jew, and it helped her slip through the net many, many times. But her luck finally ran out. On her 21st birthday, she got caught in a roundup and was identified as Jewish. She was taken to a police station, and a policeman took her in the back and beat her within an inch of her life. She thought she was going to die. He beat her without mercy. And then he told her, "You have a choice. You are going to do one of two things. You are either going to come to work for us and become a Greifer." A Greifer, that's a catcher. "You are going to work for us, for the Gestapo, and you are going to catch Jews for us." That's your one choice. Your other choice, if you say no, is you are going to be put on a train and you will be dead in 3 days. Those are the only two choices you have. You will become a Greifer and catch Jews for us, or you will be dead in 3 days. What do you want to do? Stella very quickly made her choice. She wanted to be a Greifer. By the middle of World War II, you might say the low-hanging fruit was picked in Germany. The Jews who were easily catchable had been caught. There were still thousands and thousands of Jews, but they were more difficult to catch. They were blending in with society. They had false identity papers that showed they were German. They were in hiding. Somebody was hiding them and supporting them. Those were the ones that the Germans needed to catch yet. And they needed Greifers, catchers. Stella Goldslag went on to become the most successful of all the Greifers that the Gestapo ever hired. She took on her role with relish. Sometimes we use the expression, "it takes one to know one." And I don't know if you can kind of grasp that. Quite a number of years ago, some boys from our church went to a distant city for a day outing, just to kind of go see the sights, and they had a few things they wanted to do. And they were in this very large, distant city, just walking the sidewalk in a big downtown, kind of skyscrapers on all sides. And they weren't wearing straight-cut suits or anything like that, just a group of youth boys out for a Saturday. And a man came up to them and stopped them, and he said, "You're Mennonites, aren't you?" And they kind of stammered around, well, yeah, how do you know? And he wouldn't tell them. He just said, I thought so. And he walked away. Now, they didn't know the truth of the matter, but what they supposed later, that was a Mennonite. That was probably an ex-Mennonite. And it takes one to know one. You know, you're just listening to someone talk, and like if they say Yews, you know they're from Lancaster County, maybe. But if they say Yuns, well, they're from Western Pennsylvania. It takes one to know one. You look for the little mannerisms, kind of like the way they move their hands or the way they talk or the way they do things. A Jew can pick out a Jew. That's why at this stage of the war, the Germans needed Greifers. They needed catchers. They knew someone who could pick a Jew out in a crowd, someone who was hiding. Stella had a particular way that she operated. She was given a supervisor and a salary. She actually drew a paycheck from the Gestapo. Her job was to catch Jews. She had a clothing allowance, so she could buy nice clothes and do herself up very nicely. And she was already in her day considered a nice-looking woman. She spent her day about town. She would sit in restaurants and watch the people in the restaurant. She would go in stores and watch the people in the stores. She would walk the streets and observe the people walking toward her. And her target was Jewish men. She was looking for a fellow who was Jewish, who was pretending to be German and hiding. Stella was exceedingly successful in what she did. When she identified someone that she thought was Jewish, him right there, I heard the way he said something to the waitress. And a Jew would talk like that. She would wait for a moment to catch him alone, maybe like when he left the restaurant. And she would start walking beside him, strike up conversation. And then when they had a private moment, she would get more serious. And she would turn to him with a frightened look on her face and big eyes, and she would say, I need help. I'm a Jew and I'm hiding and I'm scared. Would you help me? Her modus operandi, she was almost never wrong, like she could smell a Jew. And she targeted men. And she would say, I'm desperate, I have nowhere to go. Could I come live with you? And she would move in and become a live-in girlfriend. And as they lay together at night, going before they went to sleep, she would pour out all her fears and insecurities, and she would get him talking. And she would learn which of his relatives were still alive, and where were they hiding? And where did he get his identity papers, those counterfeit ones that were so good? And when she thought she had milked the last little bit of information from him, she would slip away and call the Gestapo, and they would come and arrest him and round up all of his surviving family members and friends and send them to a death camp. And then Stella would do herself up really nice looking, and she would go to town looking for the next man. It's estimated that in the last 3 years of the war, Stella caught over 600 Jewish men doing that. Stella was evil. Stella was immoral. She was amoral. She had no morals whatsoever. Stella was going to look out for Stella. And if Stella needed to sell you to the concentration camp to save herself, you were going to the concentration camp. After the war, or during the war, she started to become famous in Jewish circles. No one quite knew who she was, but they knew that there is this evil Jewish woman. And she's catching the men. And she's using her looks and her body to catch them. They called her, not knowing her name, they said, there's the blonde poison around. There's a woman who is beautiful death. After the war, Germany lost, and Stella was in a tight spot. She had worked for the losing side. And there were plenty of people who survived the war that knew that there was such a person as the blonde poison and that beautiful death lady. Who was she and where was she now? Stella hid and almost got away with it. But the kind of the tricky thing about Stella is that she was greedy. After the war, a program was set up in Germany to compensate persecuted Jews. If they could prove they lived in Germany and was a Jew during World War II and had survived, they could receive some monetary compensation from the German government. That was too good for Stella. She wanted that money too. So she applied. She was standing in line in a relief office, and somebody ahead of her or behind her started thinking about her. And they thought, I think that's her. I think I saw her with my brother who disappeared. Or isn't that the woman who lived with my cousin right before she disappeared and everybody else in our family was killed? Stella was turned in. She was arrested and put on trial, and Stella went to prison. She spent 10 years in prison for what she had done. She was vehement in her own defense. She was bold at the trial. She declared that she was innocent. It's all a terrible mistake. She complained how difficult it was to be in jail. She said, I get no joy, no sun, no sky, no flowers, and they won't even play music for me in here. And she knew why this was happening to her. All those other Jewish women, I'm still too good looking for them. It's jealousy. That's why they're doing this to me. Stella never admitted that she had done anything wrong. It seems that Stella never repented. She spent her 10 years in jail and was released. Somehow, Stella had plenty of money. She evidently had been paid very well by the Germans during the war and had managed to hang on to it. But Stella was lonely. Stella liked male companionship. Seemed like Stella was always able to get a man. She went through 5 husbands and more boyfriends than anyone could count. Stella didn't want to be alone. She lived all the way into her 80s. But in the end, she did die alone and friendless. Stella Goldslag committed suicide. There's a common thread that runs between Erica's mother and Stella. Both of them were in desperate circumstances. Very similar circumstances, but desperate circumstances. Both of those in those desperate circumstances had to make choices about what they were going to do. They made opposite choices. Whoever Erica's mother was, her name is gone and forgotten, nobody knows who her mother was. Her mother made a selfless choice. You know, if you didn't have anything left, like the lady in the black back there, let's say everything else is gone, her home's gone, her husband's gone, all she's got left is that baby she's holding. Would she keep it all the way to death? or would she throw it out the window? Taking a great risk that maybe it won't be killed in the fall, and maybe some kind person will find it, and maybe it won't freeze to death alongside the tracks. She was selfless. She threw away the child. As Erica said, on her way to death, she threw me to life. That was probably pretty hard. How do you think that mother felt after she threw the baby? Do you think she just sat down in the cattle car and gave up? Must have been a very difficult thing. In similar desperate circumstances, Miss Stella made a very different choice. She chose self-preservation. If I have to do very despicable things, if I have to be exceedingly immoral, if I have to sell people to their death, I am willing to do all of those things if I get to live another day. Question for you tonight is, where are you on the spectrum of self? I doubt you're where Stella is. You're not Stella Goldslag. That's not you. I don't know that you're quite Erica's mother either, where it's nothing about you anymore and it's only looking out for the best of others. You're probably somewhere in between. You probably don't know where you are, because most people aren't going to find out where they are on the issue of self until they're placed in very difficult circumstances. It's only when you are in a very difficult situation that your truest colors get shown. And maybe someday you'll be placed in a very difficult situation. And then what's true about you with respect to self will be known. We avoid desperate situations, if at all possible. And I think sometimes to that end, God allows people to be driven into corners. If you ever find yourself kind of driven into a difficult corner, maybe it was actually God that did that because he wanted to see what you were. Didn't that kind of happen to Job? God allowed him to be put in very difficult circumstances because he wanted to see. No, I think I'm not saying that quite right. God knows what you are. He wants it to be known in public what you are. So he lets you be put in a circumstance where the ones around you are going to be able to see what you really are. Now you're going to have to go through a very difficult thing for everyone to find out who you are, but God would like for everyone to find out who you are. So he's going to let you go through that difficult thing. Turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. Go down to verse 24. Matthew chapter 16, verse 24. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then shall he reward every man according to his works. Someone has said that self will destroy the work that God had wanted to do in your life. You know how it says in the scripture, God says, I know the plans that I have for you. I have good plans for you. Plans of peace to give you an expected end. That means a planned out end. I have a plan for you and it is good. But God does not force his plans on anyone. He allows you to choose. Self will destroy the work that God had wanted to do in your life. I like this quote here. Self is the last enemy to be destroyed. It will make any concession if only it be allowed to live. Like you will let yourself make some compromises, so long as you don't have to give up. Self will permit you to do anything, sacrifice anything, suffer anything, be anything, go anywhere, take any liberties, bear any crosses, anything. If only you will allow it to live. Self dies hard. So the question I'll leave you with tonight is, where do you actually think you are on that spectrum of self? You're not a Stella Goldslag. I don't think any of you are that despicable. You're not that selfish. I don't know that many of us are as selfless as Erica's mother was in her final moments, but you're somewhere on that spectrum of self. How does God view where you are? Have you done what was encouraged by Jesus Christ? If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. And whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. Call for a song.